On December 5, 2005, former U.S. Marine and U.N. weapons inspector in Iraq, Scott Ritter, spoke at the Venice United Methodist Church in Venice Beach, California. Ritter is the author of the new book, Iraq Confidential, The Untold Story of the Intelligence Conspiracy to Undermine the U.N. and Overthrow Saddam Hussein, published by Nation Books. The title of the presentation was, How We Got Into Iraq and How to Get Out. Mr. Ritter was joined in conversation by Lila Garrett, host of Connect the Dots, a radio program airing on listener-sponsored KPFK 90.7 FM Pacifica Radio for Los Angeles and Southern California. The show can be heard live Monday mornings from 7 to 8 a.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, or online at kpfk.org. Archives of the show are also available at kpfk.org. The event was produced by U.S. Tour of Duty, a nonprofit project of social and environmental entrepreneurs that supports the anti-war advocacy of Iraq veterans, military families, policy analysts, and performers by organizing public forums, developing communication strategies, and producing video content. They can be reached online at ustourofduty.org. This audio program was produced by the LA Sound Posse and is licensed under a Creative Commons Sharealike Attribution License. It can be downloaded for free at radioforall.net. We encourage the copying and dissemination of our work by all listeners as part of an effort to build a civic media distribution system. Visit us online at www.lasoundposse.org. And now, Scott Ritter, speaking in Venice on December 5, 2005, at the Venice United Methodist Church on How We Got Into Iraq and How to Get Out. He is introduced by Jeff Norman of U.S. Tour of Duty.
As Chief Weapons Inspector for the United Nations Special Commission in Iraq, Scott Ritter was labeled a hero by some, a maverick by others, and a spy by the Iraqi government. In charge of searching out weapons of mass destruction within Iraq, Scott was on the front lines of the ongoing battle against arms proliferation. His experience in enemy territory served as the basis for his book, Endgame, which explored the shortcomings of American foreign policy in the Persian Gulf region and also explored alternative approaches to handling the Iraqi crisis. Scott went back to Iraq in 2000 to film a documentary called In Shifting Sands, The Truth of UNSCOM and the Disarming of Iraq. Scott has had an extensive and distinguished career in government service. He is a ballistic missile technology expert who worked in military intelligence during a 12-year career in the U.S. Armed Forces, including assignments in the former Soviet Union and the Middle East. A former major in the U.S. Marines, Scott also spent several months of the Gulf War serving under General Norman Schwarzkopf with Marine Central Command Headquarters in Saudi Arabia. Scott's new book is called Iraq Confidential, The Untold Story of the Intelligence Conspiracy to Undermine the UN and Overthrow Saddam Hussein, published by Nation Books. As Seymour Hersh says, the important thing to know about Scott Ritter is that he was right. Ladies and gentlemen, Scott Ritter.
It's a great pleasure for me to interview Scott Ritter, and he's been on my show about four times, but this is the first time I've actually ever met him. I just read an op-ed piece, Scott, that you wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle, in which you accuse the Congress of being disingenuous, and you use names like Dianne Feinstein and other names of major, senators and congresspeople. And your implication is that they knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction when they voted for the war. I want to point out that 125 Democrats voted against the war originally in the House, and 23 Democrats voted against the war in the Senate. But many didn't, and many of those knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction, like Dianne Feinstein. Why did they vote for the war?
Well, first of all, I'll correct the record. I can't say that they knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I think we need to be clear. Nobody knew that except the Iraqis themselves. They've been trying to make a case that there weren't any weapons of mass destruction. But I and others couldn't certify. We're not in a position to certify Iraq as being 100% free of weapons of mass destruction. That's why I continue to press for the return of weapons inspectors to let them do the job before we go to war. What's critical is that you don't go to war based upon what you don't know. You go to war based upon what you know with absolute certainty. It's not a guessing game. It's not gee, maybe, whatever. We're talking about putting American lives on the line to fight and die for our country. So it's not about I think there might be. It has to be we know with absolute certainty that there are. And what I can say is that Dianne Feinstein and every other Democrat and every Republican who voted for this war had no access to any information whatsoever that certified beyond a shadow of a doubt that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Worse, Dianne Feinstein is a member of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee who's responsible for providing oversight on matters pertaining to intelligence, told me face-to-face that she had not been provided with any information that sustained the Bush administration's assertions that Iraq had reconstituted its weapons of mass destruction or were continuing to hide them. So why she voted for the war? It obviously wasn't about national security. What I ask everybody to understand when we talk about the war in Iraq is that we all try to understand from a national security perspective. There had to be a threat out there that justified us going to war. If you do this, like me, you're going to go crazy. Because I think when you take a look at what we've done in Iraq, it's been about as bad for the national security of the United States as you can possibly imagine. What I ask you to is take off the national security hat and put on your domestic American politics hat, and now you understand why they voted for war, especially in the post-9/11 environment, where to stand up against the president, President George W. Bush, was likened to an act of treason. But worse, look, Bush may have sent troops into Iraq in March of 2003, but you take the speech he delivered to the American public in that month, and compare and contrast it with the speech made by Bill Clinton in December 1998, they're one and the same. This has been a process of deceiving the American people for more than a decade by Democrats and Republicans alike.
You know, I've heard you say many times that Clinton, his hands are not clean when it comes to our being in Iraq, that he was very much responsible for our present policy, that we continue to bomb Iraq and so on. Let me ask you this question, because you said that on my show at length, as a matter of fact. If Clinton were president today, do you think the situation would be the same in Iraq?
What? That's Bill on the phone offering advice. The thing about, and I pointed out in a book that I wrote in 1999, called Endgame. When you talk about policy, you have sustainable policy and unsustainable policy. And what I tried to point out is that when it comes to our Iraq policy, the Clinton administration had unsustainable policy. And the thing about unsustainable policy is that you can't sustain it. That's why they use that word, unsustainable. And eventually you're going to hit a brick wall and you're going to have to change track. And the way the Clinton administration was tacking when it comes to Iraq was inevitably towards war. And not just war with Iraq, but a war that would require the unilateral invasion of Iraq and occupation of Iraq by the United States, because the international community would not support this war. We would not be able to get back into the Security Council. We would not be able to build a coalition. I said this in 1999. So had Bill Clinton been president, yes, we would have ended up in war in Iraq, and the results would have been the same, because it was Bill Clinton's policy that was inherited by George W. Bush. Now, There is an inkling of I have to put a little asterisk there. George W. Bush went to war not just because he inherited Bill Clinton's policy on Iraq, but because of 9/11. And, you know, there's a couple of caveats here, whether or not Clinton, A, would have failed to the level that the Bush administration failed in the months leading up to 9/11. Maybe the FBI would have captured some of these terrorists before they hijacked airplanes. But also, I don't know if Bill Clinton, in fact, as I can say, that Bill Clinton most probably would not have exploited the tragedy of 9/11 in the manner that George W. Bush did, misleading a nation, indeed a world, into war with Iraq.
So in other words, the answer is no. If Bill Clinton were still in office, we would not be in the same situation.
No, Bill Clinton would eventually, that his unsustainable policy would have become unsustainable. And at that point in time, Bill Clinton would have had no choice but to move forward unilaterally with the massive application of military force. We were headed in that direction. It was under Bill Clinton that the Congress of the United States passed the Iraq Liberation Act, authorizing $100 million of U.S. taxpayers' funds to go and fund Ahmed Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress, when everybody knew that Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress had no means whatsoever to take on Saddam Hussein. So if you're talking about engaging Saddam with a force that can't sustain that engagement, eventually you're going to have to reinforce. And the only vehicle for reinforcement is American troops. So we would have invaded Iraq and overthrown the government, whether it's Gore, Clinton, or whatever, because it's unsustainable policy.
Right. So we would have gone into Iraq, and we would have overthrown the government. But my question really is, would we be out by now if Bill Clinton or Gore were in power?
No, because the United States of America, the foreign, look, Madeleine Albright and Sandy Berger were as ignorant about Iraq as Donald Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice. All right? In order to successfully navigate the treacherous waters of Iraq, it requires an in-depth understanding of what Iraq is, what the ethnicities of Iraq are, what the religions of Iraq are, how they interact, what their aspirations are. You have to parse out the Shia. It's not a homogeneous entity. It's a group of diverse subgroups that don't necessarily cooperate with one another. The same with the Sunnis. Some are secular. Some are Islamic fundamentalists. The Kurds have two groups, one that's supportive of was supportive of Saddam Hussein, the other one that's supportive of the Iranians. Clinton didn't understand this. Bush doesn't understand it. It's not just about getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athist regime, as despicable and tyrannical as they were, represented the glue that held Iraq together. And once you remove Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athist party, Iraq will devolve into chaos and anarchy. It doesn't matter if a Republican or Democrat's in office in the White House. Iraq could care less. Iraq will devolve into chaos and anarchy, and unless you have an understanding of the complexities of Iraq, you're not going to be able to glue it back together. So I think once going into Iraq, the results are going to be the same. It's inevitable. America does not understand Iraq.
You know, I'm not sure you answered my question. In today's New York Times, it says U.S. forces try new approach, raid and dig in. And what they've been doing is they've been bombing, you know, killing lots and lots of innocent people. It's as though the war is suddenly heated up in a tremendous way, in a very dramatic way. And instead of hitting and running, which is what we've been doing, they are now digging in. And my question to you, and I promise it's the last time, is if Bill Clinton were in power, do you believe that we would be raiding and digging in? Do you believe, now, for example, Cy Hirsch just wrote an article in which he said that Bush will never get out of Iraq. He will never get out of Iraq. He believes that God has told him to go into Iraq, and he's going to go there and he's going to stay there. And God, he's talking to God. He's not talking to us, and he's not listening to us. He's actually written, Cy Hirsch has written this article. Do you believe that would be true of Clinton as well?
Well, I think Clinton showed a proclivity for cutting and running when you take a look at what he did in Mogadishu. I think Bill Clinton would have gotten us involved in Iraq. I think we'd still be there today. But unlike the Bush administration, I think the Clinton administration would be desperately searching for an exit strategy. I think the Clinton administration lacked the discipline of the Bush administration in staying the course. I'm not saying this is a positive thing about the Bush administration, but I'm not saying that the Clinton administration's proclivity for cutting and running is a positive thing, too. The Clinton administration is as guilty of politicizing the Department of Defense as the Bush administration was. Under Bill Clinton, senior generals were selected not because of their skill as military professionals, but because of their penchant for, being in ideological alignment with the Clinton administration. So the generals would have done what Clinton told them to do, the same way Bush has lined up his generals in the same way. But no, I don't think that we would be digging in and reinforcing failure. I think Bill Clinton right now would be desperately searching for a solution to the problem in Iraq, which, again, your focus of your question, you're talking about situation in Iraq. This is not about what's going on inside Iraq. I wish everybody would understand that. This is about what's going on inside Washington, D.C. And so long as our elected officials continue to cravenly support this war through their votes, regardless of what the will of the people represents, we're going to be in Iraq. Our troops will continue to fight and die because politicians don't have the courage to stand up and say enough is enough.
Well, just playing devil's advocate here for a minute. We did have a right-wing congressman, Murtha, who is very much a military man and has really never seen a war he didn't support, who suddenly stood up and said, this is enough, we've got to get out of Iraq, and the word now was used. We need to get out of Iraq now. Now, you've said repeatedly that the Democrats have not stood up, that they can't be depended upon to stand up. And yet one of the strongest Democrats, one of the strongest Democratic hawks in the Congress did stand up, and a lot of people stood behind him. Why don't you, and now Nancy Pelosi has come out in support of Murtha. Why don't you believe that this is a groundswell, or do you believe that it's a groundswell, and that it will lead to our getting out of Iraq?
I think that, first of all, I respect Congressman Murtha's military service. He was a colonel in the United States Marine Corps who served with honor and dignity in Vietnam. He's a man who has a penchant for what I would say putting blinders on when it comes to the support of the military. And as a result, this is a man of honor who knew the horrors of Vietnam, who voted for the war in Iraq. He's now come to his senses, and he has taken a very courageous stand and spoke out against the war. But here's the issue. I asked two things. You can't have a groundswell that's superficial. A groundswell implies that you have a massive movement from the ground up that's starting to have an impact. I would ask, you know, would Murtha have made his statement had President George W. Bush's approval ratings been 60% instead of 37%? Would Nancy Pelosi dare stand next to Murtha if Bill Clinton's approval ratings had been 60% instead of 37%? This sudden, you know, act of courage on the part of Democrats to speak out against this war seems to be conveniently timed at a moment when the president's poll ratings are hitting rock bottom. And the reason why I bring this up is I'd like to ask Representative Murtha and Nancy Pelosi, at what point in time did this become a bad war? When you voted for it, or today when Americans are dying? Because with all due respect to Representative Murtha, when you go to war, Americans die. That's what it's about. We put 5,000 Marines across the beach at Iwo Jima that aren't coming home. We put several thousand Marines across the beach at Okinawa who aren't coming home. But that was a war worthy of the sacrifice. It's not about the number of dead. It's about why they're dying. And the fact that we illegally invaded Iraq in violation of international law when Saddam Hussein did not pose a threat against us, that's why you must be against this war. Not because George W. Bush's poll ratings are suddenly conveniently low.
You're being very... You're being very cynical about the Democratic Party. I wonder why. All right, well, now we're in Iraq, and people are dying, and more innocent people will be killed with these terrible bombings. And all of this seems to fuel Bush's resolve. You know, we're dealing with people who are not maybe quite sane, and who have no respect at all for life. That's clear. The question is this. Here we are, a group of people who are in the peace movement. And it's taken a long time for the peace movement to grow at all. We really do have Cindy Sheehan to thank for that. Largely Cindy Sheehan to thank for that. She has ignited the peace movement. What do we do to make this translate, this Murtha thing, this new Bush's disapproval ratings, which are only 37% of the country support him now. Over 69% of the country are against the war. We have a head of steam going. What do we do to capitalize on it?
I can only say continue to speak truth to power, continue to inform and educate yourselves, and seek to build the widest possible coalition of people who share your point of view on this issue. What's important is to make the anti-war issue an anti-war issue, and not an umbrella for every other progressive issue out there. Because if you do this, while you may believe in all the things that you believe in, and I support it, and I think it's wonderful, you didn't allow yourselves to be exploited by others through wedge politics. If this is about anti-war, make it about anti-war, then you should be talking to the veterans of foreign war, you should be talking to the American Legion, you should be talking to labor unions, you should be talking to farmers, you should be talking to all of America who may not share the same ideology, goals, or objectives that you have across the entire spectrum of progressive thinking, but on the case of war, you're one and the same. And that's what I would say you'd have to do, is start to build a coalition right now at the point in time when you have momentum.
Right. And you're talking about a coalition as in a peace movement, so that we are visible and audible and all of that. But what about controlling the political process? What about creating an atmosphere in which we can pick the candidates who run?
Well, that's
what about absolutely changing the Congress?
Well, people ask me, how long do I think we're going to be in Iraq? And I say, again, throw away your national security hat, because Iraq makes no sense from a national security perspective. If it's about national security, we should be out now. We should have been out last week, last month, last year. We should never have gone in. But we're there. It's not about national security, ladies and gentlemen. It's about domestic American politics. And right now we have a Congress that has been co-opted by their voting record, not just on the war, but on the Patriot Act and on every issue leading up to this war. And the sad thing is these congressional representatives, senators and congressmen, don't have the courage. Very few have the courage. But most of them have not shown a penchant for having the courage and standing up and doing the right thing for the rule of law and for the American people. We the people, the Constitution begins with that. We have to remember we're the ones responsible. So the responsibility falls on our shoulders. If our elected representatives aren't going to do the job that needs to be done, then we need to clean house. And if you don't clean house, understand this. How long will we be in Iraq? 2 or 3 national election cycles, or what it takes to naturally purge Congress of everybody who has co-opted themselves through their voting record. But if we wait that long, how many dead Americans, how many dead Iraqis, and how worse will the situation become for America? We have an election coming up in 2006. And while elections are complicated issues, I would say for the peace movement, the following litmus test must apply. If you voted for the war and you haven't publicly recanted that vote and come out in favor of an immediate withdrawal of American troops from Iraq, you no longer deserve the honor and privilege of representing the people of the United States of America, and you go home.
So just in simple political terms, you seem to be saying that our number one priority in terms of supporting candidates is to stop the war. Is that right?
If you're a peace candidate, the answer is yes.
Okay.
If you're some other issue candidate, now you've complicated the situation. So keep it simple. The war is the single most important right. issue we face as a nation.
So that is the number one priority in whom we support. Is that not right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Now, let's talk about what the Bush administration is doing. I remember hearing Wolfowitz say very quickly after Saddam Hussein was apprehended, he said, well, look, you know, all right, so there are no weapons of mass destruction. We're prepared to admit that. But what we really wanted all along was regime change. He actually got on the air and said that, Wolfowitz. And don't forget, he was Undersecretary of Defense at the time, so he was a person of authority. Well, now we've apprehended, indeed, Saddam Hussein. And why doesn't the Bush administration declare victory and get out with honor, if I may use that expression, under these circumstances? What are we still doing in Iraq? That's the question.
Well, besides killing Americans and killing Iraqis,
we're
sustaining
a
Bush administration policy of regional transformation. Every single time Bush administration officials go before Congress, they talk about the policy of regional transformation, the necessity of getting rid of failed governments, rogue governments that govern failed states. And Iraq was always seen by the Bush administration, never shared with the American public until after the fact, but Iraq was always seen as the first step of implementing this broader policy of regional transformation in the Middle East, which is part of a global policy of of global hegemony, where the United States in the post-Cold War environment views the world as our own big pie that we get to slice up as we see fit, take their resources to feed our economic machine, to feed the lifestyle that the American people have become addicted to. So this is why we continue to proceed not only in Iraq, but with Iran, with Syria, and with the overall policies that we're pursuing in the Middle East and elsewhere.
Well, now you've mentioned Iran, and on my show, I remember that you said that it is the United States policy to in the future, at the time you said in the very near future, to in fact bomb Iran. What is our policy toward Iran?
Well, first of all, bombing is not a policy. Bombing is an action. The policy is regime change. And our policy as we speak is regime change in Iran. The president said this. Condoleezza Rice has said this. I'm not making it up. Read the testimony of Condoleezza Rice recently, last month, to the Congress of the United States of America, where not only did she say we need to be prepared to stay in Iraq for 10 years, minimum, but she said Congress needs to gird itself for the possible eventuality of war between the United States and Iran. And when the Congress people said, excuse me, don't you plan on seeking the advice and consent of Congress before you move forward militarily against Iran? She said, I will say nothing that ties the hands of the commander-in-chief when it comes to his prerogative of waging war. The intent is to remove the regime. The vehicle for removal is military action. When I spoke to you the first time about Iran, the plan was that the United States would install John Bolton as the ambassador. He was supposed to be installed in May. Then they would immediately in June seek to transfer the Iranian case from the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna to the Security Council in New York City, where they would immediately seek to have economic sanctions imposed on Iran because of a nuclear weapons program that hinged on a specific piece of intelligence where the international inspectors had found highly enriched uranium of weapons grade on material inside Iran, thereby certifying the Bush administration's assertion that there is a covert nuclear weapons program. Russia and China were balking on issuing sanctions, which is why George W. Bush in October of 1994 ordered the Pentagon to be prepared to launch a massive aerial bombardment of Iran starting in June. Not to start bombing, but to be prepared. But, and that's why I said what I said to you. A couple things happened. Bolton didn't get immediately nominated. There was a delay. In fact, the president had taken advantage of a recess to slide Bolton in without the consent of Congress. Second of all, in July, the intelligence information that the United States was using was shown by the International Atomic Energy Agency not to point to Iran, but rather to reinforce the Iranian contention that it had acquired centrifuge enrichment devices from Pakistan on the black market, and the uranium isotope in question was Pakistani in origin. This made it very difficult for the Bush administration to transfer the case from Vienna to New York, and you saw what happened in August and September of this year when they tried to do that. There was hesitation, so the Bush administration sought a compromise position where Iran was condemned, but the case still remains in Vienna. As we speak, the Bush administration continues to push to have the Iranian case transferred from Vienna to New York, and the second that happens, it will set in motion a sequence of events that can only terminate with American military intervention in Iran.
And you believe that this is going to happen during the Bush administration?
I believe the Bush administration wants it to happen during the Bush administration. I believe that there might be some hesitancy on the part of the Bush administration to do something before the 2006 election, but keep in mind that he has 2 years to wage mayhem following that election, and I think he has every intention to complete the task he has assigned himself in the Middle East, which goes far beyond simply removing the Iraqi dictator from power, and it includes regime change in Iran and Syria at a bare minimum.
Let's talk a little bit, just to stay on this subject for just a moment, because it's huge, and it's something that, as members of the peace movement, we will do almost anything to avoid. So you said on my show that you really expected us to bomb Iran during the summer, but you just pointed out yourself that Bolton was stopped by the Congress. He wasn't stopped permanently, but he was interrupted by the Congress. And there have been disruptions because of the Congress. For example, in this last vote that was manipulated by, well, first of all, Murtha's resolution to get out now was manipulated by the Republicans, and finally it just fell apart. But it did start the ball rolling toward thinking about getting out, and now almost every congressman has a plan to get out. So that momentum is starting. Now, what do we do to stop our government, our people, from bombing Iran? We can't allow that to happen.
Simple solution. Vote in a Democratic majority in the House of Representatives in the 2006 election.
But these are the very Democrats that you're accusing of really chickening out every time their feet are put to the fire.
No, so, I said fire those Democrats and vote in a new batch of Democrats right. Who won't chicken out.
Yeah. So we're back to getting out of Iraq as our first priority for every candidate that we support, right?
Anti-war position is a good position.
Yeah. All right, now when you talk about getting out of Iraq, I was just with a group of people the other day, all of whom are progressives, and they're very decent people, and they vote the way most of us vote and so on. And yet, they did not agree with me that we should just get out now. And they use that expression, cut and run, which kind of stops you dead, you know, when you hear it. They said, well, we can't get out now. We can't just get out because there will be civil war in Iraq. And I heard George McGovern say, well, that's what they said when it was time to get out of Vietnam, that there would be civil war in Vietnam, and there wasn't. As a matter of fact, things got better rather quickly once we were out. What do you think will happen if we just simply get out of Iraq, which we eventually, I believe, will do because we will have no other place to go? If we get out of Iraq, what do you think will happen? You think that they will be, that their civil war, which already exists, will be heated? What do you think will happen?
Well, there's going to be a civil war. It's unavoidable. As I said earlier, the glue that held Iraq together was Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athist regime. As imperfect as it was for 30 years, it had served as a vehicle to bridge ethnic differences, to bridge religious differences, to suppress those who didn't agree with the regime. And we got rid of them. Not only that, we got rid of the Ba'athist Party. We purged Iraq of every aspect of a system that had held it together as a unified nation state for 30 years. And as a result, it has collapsed in the chaos and anarchy that's built around these fractures in Iraqi society. We've been trying to paper over these fractures through what we call democratic processes, elections, constitutions, etc. There's nothing democratic about what's happening in Iraq, especially the processes. Every time they have a vote, instead of unifying Iraq, it further divides and fractures Iraq. The tension is building up. Look, you guys live out west here. You'll hopefully understand the following analogy. You know, when you got brush or a forest, you got to keep it pruned up. You got to keep the fuel level down so if there's a fire, it won't spread rapidly. It won't burn at high temperatures. It's easily contained. Saddam Hussein was a man who carried out controlled burns in Iraq. He kept the tension down. He kept the fuel from building up. We got rid of Saddam. Iraq is a nation that's packed with fuel, and it's going to burn. It has to burn. You can't stop it from burning. There's going to be a civil war. End of story. Anybody thinks there's a magic solution, tap the magic wand and it goes away, you're wrong. What's important is that American troops not be in Iraq when it finally explodes into the conflagration that's going to happen. I would also say to those who say, well, morally, we can't just walk away from Iraq and let it have a civil war. What I would tell you is this. The United States of America had a constitution that was passed at the end of the 18th century. And that constitution, as wonderful as I believe that document is, didn't paper over some serious issues in this country, like slavery and the issue of states' rights versus federal rights. It took a bloody civil war for America to sort out its own problems. And right now, Iraq is a broken nation with serious issues, and it must be sorted out. And they're the ones who are going to have to decide on how to sort it out. And if they choose violence, as tragic as that is, so be it. America must leave Iraq and then seek to contain and mitigate the violence. Because unlike Vietnam, the Vietnam War didn't follow us home. Iraq today is a breeding ground of anti-American Islamic fundamentalism. And if we just leave Iraq and we don't contain and mitigate that violence, it will follow us to Europe, to the Middle East, to Australia, and to the United States. So we need to have a coherent strategy that rejects the unilateral application of military force and embraces multilateral diplomacy, which means genuine diplomacy, that long-lost art form we seem to have forgotten as a nation. Genuine diplomacy where we interact with the world as equals with shared common values, not as a hyperpower that dictates solutions to the rest of the world's population.
All right. I want to encourage you to write your questions, to get them ready, because there'll be two more questions from me, and then we'd like to gather your questions and present those to Scott. I haven't heard you mention war profiteering. We have raised $300 billion for this war in Iraq. Every time the Congress has asked for $80 billion more, and that's a magic number, isn't it? It's always $80 billion. They always come through with it because even those who are anti-war are afraid not to, another cliche, support our troops. Instead of supporting our troops by bringing them home and telling them the truth, they feel they have to give this money. Now, Halliburton has unbelievable contracts. I have these figures at home in Iraq, none of which they have fulfilled. But they have skimmed openly, blatantly, and don't even deny it, under the name Kellogg Root. Kellogg,
what? Brown Root.
Brown Root, yeah. And also Bechtel has done the same thing. And General Electric has done the same thing. And they continue to do it, and they also did it with Katrina, and they do it just openly. Now, when Bremer left Iraq, he put in 55 heads of various ministries, and they were all either flunkies of the United States or actually Americans. And they were 55 of them, the head of transportation, the head of oil, the head of energy, the head of everything. Why aren't you discussing, or why every time we're together, I always try to get you to discuss the fact that really the United States is treating Iraq as a colony, economically and in every other way. Why don't you emphasize that, or don't you think that it's a big factor in all of this?
Well, I think it's a huge factor. I prefer to emphasize a war that's killing Americans as opposed to a process that robs the American people blindly. I mean, we've been living with a process that robs American people blindly for years. But I'm not trying to ignore this. This is a serious issue, and it's a manifestation of the disingenuous way in which we went to war. If Iraq was a serious national security threat, we would have planned not only the military defeat of Saddam Hussein, but the post-war occupation of Iraq with a coherent strategy to deal with the issue of governance that includes not just putting a lackey in power, but managing this very complex modern industrial state called Iraq. The fact that we lied about this war meant that we did all that post-war planning, what little there was, in secret, and we actually held back on most of it until after we invaded, and now we issue no-bid contracts to a bunch of Department of Defense contractors who, unfortunately or fortunately for them, unfortunately for us, have links to certain administration officials. Dick Cheney, and the fact of the matter is they didn't have a plan. All of their early assumptions were we're going to go in, this is going to be easy. We're going to make our big bucks and go away. What's happened is the devolving security situation in Iraq means that for every $100 that you're putting into Iraq, you're putting about $27 of that into security. And it also means that you have this Wild West mentality for accountability. It took Saddam Hussein 10 years under sanctions to steal, and I use steal in quotations because it was his oil he was selling, but to mismanage or take advantage of the oil food program to get $1.8 billion. That's what they're targeting him for, $1.8 billion. It took Paul Bremer less than a year to lose $9 billion of American taxpayer money. Of course we have to talk about this. This is horrendous. This is horrific, and it's criminal. We need to talk about prosecuting everybody involved in this fraud, in this embezzlement scheme.
But you don't believe that One of the reasons we went in the first place was because it was a big pot of gold for Cheney and for Bechtel and for all of those companies. You don't believe that was a motivating force to begin with?
Well, the profit margin isn't big enough. No, look, that's something that happened after the fact. It's not something that happened before the fact. I mean, you could have a theory that goes along the lines that Dick Cheney in his energy committee that met in secret, and they still won't release the documents of what they talked about, had divvied up the world's oil market for some grand scheme that has the United States dominating the global economy by 2020. I believe it. He did it. But it was a grand scheme that went beyond Iraq. It dealt with Central Asia, dealt with a whole bunch of other issues. For us to simply say that it was all about Iraq, that it's all about Iraqi oil. I've talked to businessmen in the oil field, I mean CEOs of oil companies, and this was about oil. They certainly didn't talk to the oil businessmen. They talked to the oil exploiteers. They talked to the war profiteers. That's what Halliburton is. Halliburton's not an oil company like ConocoPhillips or Exxon, people that go out there and actually do the exploration and get the oil out of the ground and go from, bringing it out and getting it to market. That's not what Halliburton does. They work on the fringes of it. The companies that do oil as a business, and understand when I use the term business, it means we're going to make money. It really means we're going to make a lot of money. And to do that, you have to invest a tremendous amount of capital and then sustain that investment over a long period of time. It's about getting maximum returns for the maximum period of time. This means you need stability. And every oil executive knew that by going into Iraq the way the Bush administration was, it was not only going to destabilize Iraq, making it virtually impossible for meaningful oil exploration and oil exploitation for decades to come, but it would also translate into destabilization for the entire oil industry, not only in the Middle East, but globally. This is bad business. It's not good business. Yes, they can rake in the profits up front by jacking up the price of oil, but that's short-term profiteering. Oil businesses make money through long-term investments, and Iraq is the antithesis of the kind of stability an oil company is seeking for these long-term investments.
Well, I wasn't just talking about oil. Actually, Kellogg Brown Root is into many things. Into military uniforms. They're into feeding meals. They recently charged for 30,000 meals when they only produced 3,000. I mean, even this kind of petty thievery is not above them. And they're into all of these things, and they're also into rebuilding Iraq, and there's no evidence that there has been any rebuilding of Iraq. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the bases now. We're all under the impression that we are planning 14 bases in Iraq, and we've heard recently that that number has dwindled down to 3. What's the fact?
Well, the fact is we have over 139 semi-permanent installations in Iraq, and rather than dwindling, we actually have engaged in a new policy of sending Marines and soldiers out to close with and destroy the enemy in villages and then dig in, turning each village into its own mini-garrison, mini-fort. So we're expanding the presence in Iraq rather than reducing it. But in the long term, I think The song and flowers routine that the Bush administration anticipated has turned into a disaster, and that means that the original 14 bases that were planned, and actually construction has started on these bases, some of these bases have been identified as being untenable in the face of an active ongoing insurgency. And understand what I'm saying, that the long-term strategy of the Bush administration vis-a-vis Iraq now takes into account an active, growing, ongoing insurgency. They're not talking about winning the war in Iraq. They're talking about staying the course in Iraq, regardless of the status of the enemy opposition. But now what they're trying to do is move our bases away from populated areas and create, I think, 3 super bases are what they're talking about, where the United States takes total control of a region, including not just the town that we're in, but the entire surrounding area, so no mortars, no artillery shells can hit us, no car bombs can come close. And then we'll use these as a base to launch operations not only in Iraq, but even going outside of Iraq. But again, that's a pipe dream, because we're not there yet. Today, I think the New York Times, you just showed me an article where Marines are going into villages, clearing out the villages, clearing out what? The enemy's gone when they go in there. Then they dig in and they stay. But this is not dominating territory. This is creating additional targets. And we're going to find in the weeks and months to come that these Marines digging in are going to be taking casualties at an increasing level. Don't clap, because it's a horrible thing. It's a horrible thing for Americans to be dying in Iraq. We have a strategy that's not designed to win the war. We have a strategy that's designed to kill Americans, and that's what this is, a strategy that kills Americans. And every general, every congressman, any leader who signs up to this strategy, again, must be held accountable.
All right. Well, now it's your turn. This is, I just want to put my two cents in about you know, contributing to this incredible organization. Because this is really our only way to get information and to spread the word. It's the best way. And this group, the Tour of Duty, you know, as an interviewer, I come across a great many of these groups, all of whom are trying. But I don't really think that any of them do it as well as the Tour of Duty. So I do encourage you to support them. I think Jeff mentioned that I was involved with Americans Against War with Iraq. We have some other board members here, the Mersons and so on. And we've just made a substantial contribution to them because we think that they are so effective. So if you're able to support them, you really should, because they really get things done. All right, here we go. Believe me, legibility plays a big part in this. Bush would say that we have not had another 9/11 on our shores because we have taken the fight to the terrorists. What do you say to this argument?
It's overly simplistic and has no bearing whatsoever on reality. 1993,
clearly written.
1993, the terrorists attempted to attack the World Trade Center. They failed. It took them 8 years of planning to get us on September 11, 2001. You know, here we are 4 years later, and they haven't attacked us in America. Well, one of the reasons why they may not have attacked us in America is we've given them every opportunity to attack us abroad. The second thing is, you know, in the special operations community that I deal with quite often, one of the things we always say is make the enemy do what they want to do. It's the easiest thing. The enemy is predisposed to do something. Set up events so that the enemy does what they already want to do and take advantage of that. Some would say that Osama bin Laden attacked us on September 11, 2001 to achieve exactly the result he got. He talked about America being a crusader nation declaring war against the Islamic world. Prior to September 11, 2001, that would have been a hard sell. Today, it's the easiest sell to make outside the United States of America. Why does he need to attack us again? We're doing exactly what he wanted us to do. We are responsible for the biggest recruitment Al-Qaeda has ever had. Al-Qaeda's ranks have grown by several orders of magnitude. Anti-American sentiment in the world has exploded. There's no need to attack us again. Just wait and let us continue to weave the rope that eventually we will use to hang ourselves.
Okay, when the U.S. withdraws from Iraq, what can be done to prevent this from becoming a windfall to Iran? Has this administration bungled Iraq so badly that nothing can be done?
First of all, I'm glad you mentioned Iran and Iraq. You know, there was an eight-year war that the Iranians and the Iraqis fought in the 1980s. And the goal of the Iranian government, and remember, there's a reason why we supported Saddam Hussein in the 1980s, because he was a secular bulwark against the expansion of anti-American Islamic fundamentalism coming out of Iran. Today, when you take a look at the government that is in place in Iraq, the president is Jalal Talabani, the pro-Iranian Kurd whose forces fought against Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq war on behalf of Iran. The prime minister is Ibrahim Jafari, the president of Dawah, an Islamist party organized and equipped and trained by the Iranians, which waged war against Iraq on behalf of Iran during the Iran-Iraq war. The most powerful institution in Iraq today is the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution of Iraq, whose military wing is called the Badr Brigades. All of these are paid for, equipped, and organized by the Iranian government, and all of them fought for Iran against Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war. Thanks to the United States of America, Iran has won the Iran-Iraq war. They have succeeded in getting rid of Saddam Hussein, and they are in place today in Iraq. So it's absurd to say if we pull out of Iraq, the Iranians will slide in. They've already slid in. They've already slid in. This is why I say, and this is something, you know, that I know the peace movement won't necessarily agree with me on this one, but I believe that we've got a wildfire ready to rage in Iraq. And, you know, like any wildfire, when it burns with an intensity that sterilizes the entire area. Nothing will grow again. We need to not just about talk about getting out of Iraq, but we got to launch some control burns of our own. This means we got to get rid of the pro-Iranian elites that govern Iraq today to give the Iraqi people an opportunity to seek their own way void of outside interference.
All right, John McCain has said it is not about who they are, it's about who we are. Could you speak about America's use of torture and its consequences?
Well, I'm glad John McCain has finally got his moral compass in line, because this is a man who also says that the ends justify the means when it comes to Iraq, and a man who believes that cannot possibly believe in the rule of law set forth by the Constitution. But at least on the issue of torture, he's right. Look, I'm a trained interrogator translator for the United States Marine Corps. That means that when we capture people, I'm one of the guys that gets information from them, specially trained to do it. And I can guarantee you, in the courses I took, you don't torture people. There's two reasons. A, we're Americans, we don't do that. That's not what we're about. B, and this is where Dick Cheney's argument falls apart, B, it doesn't work. You simply cannot get usable intelligence information from people when you torture them. One of the things they taught us in this course is that you can be made to say or sign anything under any given event. They gave us information to hold and keep secret. And the bottom line is 90% of the people captured and subjected to, you know, supreme, discomfort, not torture, just supreme discomfort, spilled their guts. Many of them would sign any document put in front of them to stop the pain. And this is minimal compared to what we're doing to the prisoners under our responsibility. They say that the terrorists don't deserve the rule of law because they operate outside the framework of the rule of law. But to use that same argument, every murder, rapist, and bank robber in the United States should have the constitutional rights thrown out the window because they operate in total disregard for the law. It's not about the criminals. It's about us, we the people, who we are and what we are, and we must defend ourselves through the rule of law, because once you throw away the rule of law, it's all over. It's a slippery slope until there is no rule of law. John McCain's got it right. America can never be a nation known as a sponsor of torture.
You know, many of these questions are about the bases and about the moneyed interests as being, you know, what's really motivating us. But one of the questions, which I had difficulty reading, was as follows, if I may paraphrase. You know, we keep talking about the various conflicting groups, religious groups and so on. Didn't we have an opportunity to really encourage the secular part of Iraq? And didn't we instead fuel the fighting forces in Iraq?
Absolutely. Again, Saddam Hussein's government was a secular government. It was bigger than just the Ba'athist Party. We keep talking about the Ba'ath Party and the role they played. But especially after the 1991 defeat in the Gulf War, Saddam Hussein, being a masterful survivor, learned to reshuffle the domestic constituency he dealt with in Iraq in a way to emphasize the secular and even the moderate Islamic adherence to the religion, and de-emphasize the more fanatic elements of the Islamic religion. He built a government that was moving in that direction. I'm not here to condone Saddam Hussein or defend him. I'm stating reality. This is what was going on. Now we got rid of him, and we got rid of anybody who was affiliated with his governance, which means we got rid of every secular, moderate element inside Iraq that could possibly have held that country together. The only secular, moderate elements that could exist in post-Saddam Iraq were the ones that we injected artificially into their society post-occupation. And these had no constituency whatsoever amongst the Iraqi people, meaning that we liberated the political spectrum to be hijacked by extremists, Islamist fundamentalists, Sufi adherents, etc. And therefore, we made sure there's no chance of any moderate secular governance in Iraq so long as we continue these policies.
Okay, how do you feel about the concept of reinstating the draft in order to end the war?
I think, I understand the logic of that argument. It makes basically invests, America into the pain of going to war. I would hesitate, people, before you embrace this notion, because it means you're investing America's poor. You're investing America's minorities. But rich white boys ain't going to fight the war under a draft. I guarantee you that. The other thing I would hesitate is war is about killing. Well, let's get it through our mind. That's why I'm anti-war. That's why we're all anti-war, because it's about killing. If you have a military, though, it's training to wage war. And having been a warrior and led Marines in combat, let me tell you this. If my government, if my country sends me to go to war, I am going to terminate the enemy's life with extreme prejudice in a manner that preserves the lives of my Marines. My job is to bring those boys and girls home. That means I want the best weapons, I want the highest technology, and I want to train as professionals. You can't do this with a conscript military. If you support the draft, you're going to lower the professionalism of the American military, so if they're used in future conflicts, there's a greater chance that not only will we not dominate the battle, but more Americans are going to die, and we're not going to win. So please, let's not put the burden on the troops. If America doesn't want to go to war, then let's elect officials to represent us in higher office who support peace over war, as opposed to creating an artificiality called the draft, which solves the problem for us, because it won't solve the problem. The only thing that will solve the problem is getting elected officials who believe that we need to exhaust every venue possible short of war before we send American troops off to fight and die in combat.
I have to share this with you. You know, not everybody agrees with us here. Are we talking treason, this question says?
No.
By criticizing Bush and Cheney this way? And it's signed Joe Citizen.
Well, first of all, you can't talk treason because by talking, you're exercising your First Amendment rights of freedom of speech. Treason is, I think, the only crime that the Constitution specifically lays out, what constitutes treason. And I think you have to have witnesses to you speaking about, overthrowing the United States, overthrowing the Constitution, et cetera. No, we're not talking treason. You know, I just came from Australia. I did a week tour in Australia talking, and they've got a difficult problem in Australia. They just passed the new anti-terrorism law, which makes sedition any criticism of the government in a manner which shows the government, in a manner which empowers or could be interpreted as empowering the enemy. That means that by speaking, you've committed sedition. What I would say is the only sedition is silence, and that not to speak out in the way we are is unpatriotic in the extreme.
One of these questions was, Scott Ritter, I've heard you on the radio say that you are a conservative Republican. Are you?
I'm an American first and foremost, and I'll put my status as a conscientious American citizen above any political affiliation. If you want to dig deep into, the foundation of Scott Ritter, yeah, you'll find a very conservative individual, not neoconservative, conservative. You'll find somebody who has and continues to be a registered Republican, who only recently, I will say, started voting across party lines. I used to be one of those Republicans that went in there and went, hey, if it's got an elephant, clink. If it's got a donkey, reject it. That's the bottom line. But I would say that my positions have evolved over the course of time. And at this point in time, I'm unhappy with all political parties. I'm unhappy with all political positions because I don't think anybody represents the true will of the American people. In fact, it seems to me that politics today seems to be dominated less by citizenship and more by consumerism based upon special interests. So I don't know who I support anymore.
Okay, if you were president of the United States right now, what first three steps would you take to get us out of Iraq?
Well, I was going to say go golfing, go fishing, and whatever. To get us out of Iraq.
We've had lots of presidents like that.
Well, if we're going to talk about withdrawing from Iraq, the first step is withdrawing. All right, that's the bottom line. American troops are not doing anything positive in Iraq today. Yeah, you can sit there and say, wait a minute, aren't they training? Aren't they building schools? Overall, the presence of American troops is a negative. It exacerbates the situation. It is an accelerant to the flame that is consuming Iraq. Today was the best day we're going to have in Iraq. tomorrow is going to be worse, the day after tomorrow is going to be worse, and it's only going to go downhill. We are not going to reverse the course of operations in Iraq. This trend will not reverse itself. So the only thing we can do that is responsible is get our troops out now. The next thing I would do is repudiate the Bush administration's national security strategy of the United States of America. I would say that America no longer seeks global domination. America no longer seeks to be the global empire. America seeks to be a world leader that leads from a position of moral authority and moral strength based upon the visions and ideals that are set forth by the Constitution. And once I repudiate this national strategy, I would sit down with the rest of the world. You know, we're 280 million people. There's several billion people out there who occupy this globe with us. And I would sit down with their leaders and say, how can we work together to make a safer globe for all of us?
Talk to us about the Carlyle Group. How much of a role does the Carlyle Group have in George Bush's decisions?
I don't know. I mean, what I would say is it's not just the Carlyle Group. It's special interests. And it's not just George W. Bush. It's all American politicians. If you're worried about the Carlyle Group and George W. Bush, then you need to be worried about all special interests who buy off our politicians so they do the bidding of a small group of people instead of the bidding of the American people. But I'm not positioned. I don't have the knowledge and information to address the Carlyle Group in specific. I'm sorry. I'll try and do my research and see if I can come up with an answer next time.
Do you favor reopening the 9/11 hearings? Do you feel that there was a conspiracy there?
I don't know if there's a conspiracy. They certainly didn't serve the American people well. You know, there's a lot of conspiracy theories out there about what happened, what did or did not happen on 9/11. And you can't put these conspiracy theories to bed if you don't have a body of factually based information that is comprehensive. The best way to find out the truth of what happened on 9/11 is to have a genuine hearing. I wouldn't reopen the 9/11 hearings. I'd dismiss the panel that was there, reject their findings, and say we have to start all over again.
Are the insurgents?
This is the single most politically charged question you could ask me. First of all, we know they're not foreign. All right, I think the Pentagon's even come out and admitted that there just aren't that many foreign fighters in Iraq. And when they come to Iraq, they're not leading the revolt. They're expendable pieces of ammunition that are used by the insurgents to inflict casualties on America and to destabilize the American-backed government in Iraq. They've chosen a horrific form of waging this conflict, terrorism, but it's extremely efficient. You know, it's the same, God, we are a nation of hypocrites. It's the same things we taught the Contras to do in Nicaragua, destroy economic targets, inflict terror on the hearts of the people so that the central government loses the confidence of the people. It's what we did in Nicaragua, and it's what they're doing in Iraq today. Now, who are they? I don't know. I don't know what exactly to call them, but I do know this. If a foreign power came into my hometown and occupied my streets and kicked in the doors of my neighbors and hauled my friends out and put them in prison without charging with a crime, if they shot up my family, if they terrorized my neighborhood and they had overwhelming force, I would use whatever means necessary, up to and including car bombs, suicide bombs, anything, to terminate their presence in my community. And I would be called an American patriot.
We have experienced the power of a lying news media. In other words, a propaganda machine that feeds and relies upon our ignorance. How do we change that?
Well, the British media, what's interesting about British media, and this is part of the solution, you know, they've got, when I go to London, I wake up in the morning and I can get five newspapers. I can get The Independent, The Guardian, The Times, The Sunday Telegraph, etc. And they all have their biases. They all have prejudices. There's not a perfect single source of information out there. But when I read The Guardian, it doesn't pretend to be anything other than The Guardian. When I read The Telegraph, it doesn't pretend to be anything other than The Telegraph. The Times doesn't pretend to be anything other than The Times. So you read all five papers and, you know, an event occurs. All five papers report it differently. And, you know, some emphasize certain information, some de-emphasize other information. But in reading that, and I put on my filter, so when I read The Guardian, I got my Guardian filter on, I know that they're pro-labor, so I go, why are they emphasizing this and de-emphasizing that? The same thing with Murdoch's paper, the same thing with the Independent. And at the end of the day, by questioning and challenging the news, I become better informed myself. I have put the reliance on cutting through the BS on me. I'm not some compliant little consumer of news that says, please feed me what I need to know. I go out and I hunt down what I need to know. And that's the bottom line.
In your opinion, is the Bush agenda the beginning of World War III?
Well, we are in the global war on terror. So maybe it is. And Osama bin Laden is speaking about the necessity of the Muslim world to rise up and confront the American Christian crusader. I would say that we're not there yet, but if we're not very careful, we're on a slippery slope towards global conflagration. You know, and it's not just about Iraq and Muslims and all that. It's really a struggle of the haves and the have-nots. And that's what we really need to keep our eye on the bubble here, because, you know, we call it Christian and Muslim, but we don't understand. It's really the first world against the third world. And you know, we never asked the question after 9/11, why did they attack us? We weren't allowed to ask the question because that was unpatriotic, somehow condoning the terrorist actions. But it's like anything. I don't like to use the word global war on terror. I viewed what happened on 9/11 as a crime. Terrorism's a crime. Hijacking's a crime. Murder's a crime. And we would have had the whole world behind us had we sought to take the rule of law and hold the criminals accountable for their actions. But even if you view it as a crime, talk to any criminologist or sociologist about crime in your neighborhood. It's not just about sending the cops out to apprehend the bad guys. Everybody sits down and says, why does this happen? Why are crime rates up? What can we do to reduce crime rates? If we've got unemployment, how do we get less unemployment? If we've got, you know, bad poverty, how do we fix the poverty? There's always a cause and effect. And we talk about 9/11, we talk about why people hate us and why people attack us. We have to address how we interface with the rest of the world, because tell you what, it's unsustainable. And if, remember about unsustainable? That means that it's unsustainable. And if we continue to behave the way we are, the inevitability of global conflict between the haves and the have-nots is right there before us.
Well, in keeping with your answer here, how much of a part do you think racism plays in the American foreign policy?
It's tremendous. I mean, come on, guys, let's be honest here. Car bomb goes off in Israel, five people die in a cafe, and we got five white faces put on the front page of every newspaper and magazine we got. We wage a genocide against Iraq where we starve anywhere from 1.5 to 2.2 million little brown people to death, and we don't call them human beings. If you're not white, you don't count. And that's the bottom line of the American foreign policy. If you're not white, you don't count. And it is racist.
Well, you know, the trouble is that these questions are already repeats, many of them, of what we've already discussed. But here's one that we haven't discussed. Can you please, Mr. Ritter, tell us about UNSCOM and about your 7 years of experience in Iraq?
Well, I wrote a book about it. And,
this is your big moment.
So, so if you really want to know about UNSCOM and the 7 years experience in Iraq, but no, I won't dodge the question. Look, I'll give you the thumbnail sketch of it. First of all, let's talk about what it was. It was a group of people who were formed by a Security Council resolution who were charged with the disarmament of Iraq under extremely difficult circumstances. It's a group of dedicated professionals, technicians, etc., who sacrificed a tremendous amount of their time, energies, quality of life to go forward and attempt to do the right thing. So from the start, I want to be positive about UNSCOM, but now I'm going to give you the dreaded reality of it. See, a lot of people say UNSCOM represents the best of disarmament. UNSCOM represents the best of nonproliferation. Ladies and gentlemen, UNSCOM was a child of war. If it weren't for the first Gulf War, there would not have been an UNSCOM. You cannot create the conditions of disarmament around the world that UNSCOM did without conflict, which means UNSCOM's not a good model. It's not a model that we want to follow, because it's a model that requires the destruction of a sovereign nation, and then pretty much the illegitimate occupation of that nation by inspectors, and it leaves itself open to abuse. We inspectors thought we were there to get rid of weapons of mass destruction. But the fact is, the UNSCOM inspection process was an extension of the first Gulf War, whose objectives were regime change, overthrowing Saddam Hussein. And we never, ever had a chance. We wasted 7 years of our life pursuing a noble objective when the fact is the powers that be never intended for that objective to be met.
All right. The movement to impeach Bush and Cheney is growing in the United States. Do you support that movement?
Well, if I come right out and say I support that movement, that means that I don't believe in due process. Before we speak of impeachment, let's get the facts on the table. Let's have investigations. Let's find out what the truth is. Because you know what? It might not just be about impeachment. There might be a lot of civil crimes out there, too. Impeachment is a bureaucratic process that says you've dissatisfied the American people or whatever. I want to put these guys in jail. I don't want them out of office.
Are you pessimistic or optimistic about America's future? How do you think the world will look in 20 years?
Well, you know, I'm the eternal optimist in very dark times. I mean, the realist in me says that we are engaged in so many unsustainable actions as a nation that I don't know how we're going to turn the corner. I mean, at the end of the day, most Americans, and again, I'm in an audience that I think is the exception to this, but most Americans, if they looked in the mirror and asked themselves honestly, are you a citizen or are you a consumer? The honest answer is consumer. We're a nation that has in its constitution a preamble that begins, we the people, but we the people, for the most part, has stopped functioning as citizens. What we are consumers. We're addicted to a lifestyle that requires our elected officials to feed that addiction. That is an addiction of resources that we cannot sustain, within the limits of our own nation, which means that we have to go out and get these resources on our terms at prices we can afford from the rest of the world, which is why we have these very aggressive imperialistic foreign policies. And we're not going to break that until we, the people, stand up and say, we've got to change the way we interface with the rest of the world. And I'm not very optimistic that that's happening right now. But I do believe that things happen in cycles. And while I'm not an expert on this, I would hope, and this is where my optimism comes in, that we've reached rock bottom, that we can't get much lower as a country than we are right now, and that American people are going to get disgusted with the system we have in place and how it has failed us, and we'll start electing the right people to office and completing the cycle of accountability. It's not just about putting people in office. It's about holding them accountable for what they do in our name, make sure that they don't vote along the lines that we want, then we vote them out. And if we do this, we might be able to start trending up so that in 20 years, we live in a world that has a hope of peace, not a world that has nothing but war, a world that isn't governed by Orwellian concepts of war is peace. When we have a Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, that tells the Congress of the United States that war is the only guarantor of peace and security, we have a fundamental problem.
All right. This will be our last question. I'm going to combine several of the questions that have been handed in today. Bush has talked about, and Condoleezza Rice and all of them have talked about the possibility of bombing Iran, but they've also talked about the possibility of fighting with North Korea and Syria and other nations probably, but certainly Syria and North Korea. What do you think is going to be our future policy with these two countries?
Well, for at least the next 3 years, or till 2008, the policies are going to be exactly what they are. The Bush administration has not shown a proclivity for changing course. Sadly, mainstream Democrats don't seem to have, I mean, I think I read something that said the Democrats are incoherent on Iraq. I would say Democrats are incoherent on the world. They don't have a sound global vision on how America is to interface with the rest of the world, which means that in order to win elections, because they don't have this sound policy, they basically morph themselves into Republicans. So we got Republicans and we got Republican lights. So it doesn't matter how you vote in the next election on the international scene, you're going to have administrations that carry out similar policies. It's just a sad state of affairs. And it's because, frankly speaking, we let them get away with it. We let them get away. You know, when you talk about American democracy, you know, there is a vision of democracy out there. I come from back east, and right across the state line is a wonderful little state called Vermont. And Norman Rockwell did a little painting of the town hall meeting. And, of course, it's all lily-white Americans because, you know, we don't consider blacks or Mexicans or yellows to be true Americans. So but hopefully our society is changing. But it's a painting that shows a man standing up talking to his community. And you've got his elder looking back with admiration. You got the youth looking up. And it defines citizenship. You know, at the local level, we do citizenship pretty good. You know, we hire a mayor, and if that mayor, you know, what would happen if the mayor absconded, you know, said, oh, God, I don't, $60,000, I don't know where it went. Well, guess what? We know where you're going, out of the office, into jail. You know, if we had a town council that couldn't meet a budget, wasn't repairing the roads, wasn't maintaining the schools, out, and we get in new people. We function pretty well at the local level because there's accountability. What we have to start striving for is how we translate that accountability to the national scale. And the only way it's going to work is if we can get every community in America to believe that they have common interests. See, we work as a small community because everybody does have a common interest. But we don't work as a national community because we don't share, or at least it's perceived that we don't have common interests with everybody else. The challenge of the peace community, in addition to stopping war, is to build a coalition, but build a coalition that also at the same time constructs this national dialogue of commonality so that when we talk about what's going on with America, the people in Minnesota interpret it the exact same way as the people in California, who interpret it the same way as the people in Texas, who interpret it the same way as the people in New York. We have to start becoming a nation of shared values and ideals that goes far beyond the superficial terminology and the superficial application of those words that we have today.
Camp Casey.
Camp Casey.
That's it.
Well, I just want to say I thank everybody who came here tonight. You know, this is a little bit like preaching to the choir, but that's okay because you go forth. The United States today has in Iraq what they call the oil spot strategy, where we plop Americans down in Iraq like oil in water, and it sort of goes out. It's not going to work in Iraq, but it's not a bad concept. And I would encourage everybody here tonight to leave here and view yourselves as part of a peace movement oil spot strategy. Take the knowledge and the information that you got here tonight, continue to engage in debate, dialogue, and discussion, build the largest possible coalition, then go out there and be oil spots. Start spreading the truth, spreading empowerment to your fellow citizens so that we no longer are a nation of ignorant people who can be exploited through the tool of fear. Fear is derived from ignorance, and the best weapon we can do is empowerment through knowledge and information. Thank you for being here tonight.
This audio program was produced by the LA Sound Posse and is licensed under a Creative Commons Share Alike Attribution License. The Share Alike license allows the content to be used for any purpose, commercial or non-commercial, with the proviso that derivative works be similarly licensed. The program can be downloaded for free at radioforall.net. That's radio, the digit 4, ALL.net. The LA Sound Posse is a sound recording and distribution collective working to build a democratic and participatory media in the service of the creation of a truly democratic society. We encourage the copying and dissemination of our work by all listeners as part of an effort to build a civic media distribution system. To order copies of this talk on CD or to find out more about the LA Sound Posse, visit us online at www.lasoundposse.org. Thanks very much for listening.